Welcome to Infinite Consciousness tonight, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and I've got with me tonight again PMH Atwater, and we're going to talk about her new book, The Big Book of Near-Death Experiences, but I have to say, it's got a lot more in it than about near-death experiences. How are you, PMH?
Well, I'm fine. It's just great to be on your show again.
Thank you. I'm so glad we hooked up this time.
Yes, last time. I forgot it. Can you believe it?
Yeah.
You know, I've had radio stations that have forgotten me, but I've never forgotten them.
Oh, don't tell me that.
It's true.
I don't want to be the only one that's forgotten.
No, this is the first time I ever forgot, you know, an appointment, and I'm so ashamed.
Oh, no, don't.
Oh, dear.
So, we got a lot to talk about tonight.
Oh, yes.
So before we get started, I'm going to give you just a second to tell everybody where to find you and whatever you want to say that you want to say about who you are and what you're doing.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, my website is www.pmhatwater.com. So it's my name.com, pmhatwater.com. I've been a researcher of near-death states since 1978. My research base is nearly 4,000 adults and child experiencers. I've written 9 books on my findings, and several of my findings now have been verified in clinical prospective studies. So I've been doing this for a long time. I'm an experiencer myself, had 3 such episodes in 3 months in 1977. 3 and 3 months. I look back at that, and I call it the heavenly sledgehammer effect.
I was going to say, I don't see how you handled that.
Not very well. Yeah, I'll be very honest with you. I didn't handle it very well.
It's a lot more than just, you know, going out of your body and coming back awake.
What a lot of people don't think about or don't realize when they're talking about the near-death experience and different types of experiences people have, they don't realize that most of these experiences come from trauma or violence.
Yeah.
So you're dealing with either a broken body or
broken mind.
You know, a lot of problems with the physical body, with your life, and then you've got this to deal with on top of that.
Yeah. I don't think they know to know. You know, they don't know what they don't know. And I'll tell you something I found recently. You know, I had one of those experiences, and when you go to see a therapist about it, they can't treat you properly because they don't know what they don't know, and they try to treat you like an average patient.
If you're lucky. If you're not lucky, you wind up involuntarily committed to a psychiatric institution.
Yeah.
At least that used to happen fairly often. It doesn't happen that much now, thank goodness. Let me tell you what happened just a few months ago. There was one of the child experiencers in my research base. She's now an adult. In my book, The New Children and Near-Death Experiences, so that's about children who have these experiences. And so she was one of those. She's now an adult. She got lupus, and she's had a real problem with it. Finally was rushed to Johns Hopkins Hospital as an emergency case with lupus. And so she told the physician that she had had a near-death experience when she was younger, and he started asking her about it. This man knew about the near-death experience and its after effects, and because he knew, he switched her over to another drug, gave her a very low dose of it, and overnight she was sent home in very good shape. She hasn't had any problems since.
Really?
Because, Eva, because he knew about the after effects and he knew what to do.
What do you mean exactly? He gave her a different drug.
The average near-death experiencer cannot handle pharmaceuticals. They lose their tolerance to pharmaceuticals. So if you're going to give them pharmaceuticals, you either give them a children's dose or you give them homeopathy, or vitamins and minerals, or you turn to some of the alternatives. It's very, very difficult, sometimes dangerous, for a near-death experiencer, child or adult, to take the normal drugs that most people take. And the drugs that this woman was receiving were making her condition much worse, and it's because of that that she was ever rushed to the hospital.
That's amazing. I didn't know that.
It's in the book, the big logical book of near-death experiences. It's also in the new children and near-death experiences, where I have the cautions about sound, about light, about pharmaceuticals. But especially in the big book, I have a lot of cautions for doctors.
Oh, I guess I missed it. I kind of skipped through and picked that one up.
Let me say to all of your audience, if you are a near-death experiencer, make sure you get this book to your physician.
Does that apply to all pharmaceuticals or just a certain type of thing? I mean, like antibiotics or...
As far as I know, and as far as I've been able to tell, it applies to all of them.
Very interesting. Does it apply to people who've had, exceptional human experiences without the near-death experience?
What I'm going to say is, at least what I found, is that you can take the near-death experience and use it as a neutral model to better understand the larger experience, which I will call transformations of consciousness, no matter how caused. So that would include things like the Kundalini breakthrough, your vision quests, baptism of the Holy Spirit, various types of religious restrictions and disciplines and so forth and so on. And in other words, no matter how it occurred, if you had a breakthrough in consciousness, not just an alteration of consciousness, but if your consciousness transformed, most of these people, I'm not going to say all because that's a big word, but I'm going to say most of these people will display the same after effects as an experiencer of the near-death phenomenon.
Interesting.
And that's why you can use the near-death phenomenon to better understand what people go through in a transformation of consciousness.
What does it do to your system? Does it fool with the autonomic nervous system or something?
The near-death experience has a pattern of after effects. And those after effects are physiological as well as psychological. You know, we're all familiar with the psychological after effects, you know.
Yeah.
They become kinder and more generous and, you know, more loving and you know, are no longer afraid of death and so forth and so on. You know, we're familiar with those. Most of the books are about those, television, documentaries, movies. They all talk about that part. And many people become very, very psychic and intuitive and creative and inventive and so forth and so on. But we're not that familiar with the physiological after effects. And clearly, about 90% of them, so that's a big figure, and that's saying most of them, become highly sensitive to light and sound afterward.
I know I am.
Very sensitive to things like sunshine. Some people go the other way, though. They crave more sunlight than before, but most of them become very highly sensitive to it, and you know, can't handle it as well as they used to be.
I can't handle noise anymore.
Sound and you know, this is a real biggie, Eva, for kids, because if your child is an experiencer, you know, to be a good parent, you kick your kids out the door to go play, you know. And even with the teenagers, you expect them out there on the field practicing for their sports or their band or what have you. And if it's in the heat of the day and you know, that all that strong sunlight, you could injure your child, or the child could have a lot of problems from that, especially with their immune system, overexposure to too much sun, and also with teenagers especially. You want those decimals really high on your music. Well, if you're a child experiencer, you can't handle that. So very often the kids become odd or standoffs, or they're alone, or they're not with their peer group because they can't handle the racket. And they can see through interrelationships and what kids are really doing, and they just don't want to participate because they can see through it. They know where the actions and behavior is going to lead people, and they just say, nope, I don't want to participate in that. So they pull us to one side, and they're often made fun of and embarrassed and all this stuff. But, you know, it goes on and on from that. Electrical sensitivity, energy levels change. You know, what it's really affecting is the brain-mind assembly, the nervous system, the digestive system, and the skin. And it makes significant changes in those areas of the body.
Have you noticed if they have a tendency to have chemical imbalances and have more depression more?
Oh, sure. Sure. Depression is part of it. Very common, very commonplace for a near-death experiencer to go through bouts of depression afterward. Well, you don't fit in. You know, you try to go back to life as always, but it doesn't work.
That's interesting to know.
Well, I'd like to make an announcement, if you will allow me
to. Sure.
This is so big that I really want to make sure everybody knows this. Because of four clinical prospective studies done in three countries, plus a plethora of papers now published in peer-reviewed journals, the near-death experience today is the number one choice of scientists worldwide to study consciousness itself. Things like out-of-body experiences, the dead comeback, visitations from the other side, otherworldly journeys, all of these things are no longer relegated or associated with oxygen deprivation, anoxia, the dying brain, hallucinations, so forth and so on. We now know that these type of aspects, the out-of-body experience, dead comeback, and that kind of thing, are normal and typical to the phenomenon. Now, if you just hang there a minute, Eva, just hang there a minute with that thought. Let me say it again. Out-of-body experiences, the dead come back, visitations from the other side, otherworldly journeys are normal and typical to the experience. The experience is now verified in many places across the world, not just in the United States, as a very real and valid experience. Many of the after effects have now been verified in lengthy research and experiments. If you just look at that, that changes the conversation. That changes our conversation. When we're talking about the invisible world, when we're talking about the inner journey, when we're talking about the God within, when we're talking about the spread of human faculties, what are we capable of? Who are we really? What is life really? What is reality really? Just knowing that changes the conversation. It changes how we look at all these topics. You know, it was years ago that the physicist Wolfgang Pauli decreed that a new science is needed to explore the objective side of human consciousness and the subjective side of matter, not mysticism, but a science willing to incorporate objective and subjective avenues to discovery while recognizing the legitimacy of personal experience. We're almost there.
Yeah, they still fight it, though.
They were almost there. Of course they're still fighting it, but they're not fighting it with the kind of tools they used to because the tools are no longer valid.
Yeah, I'm with you on that, but I had a conversation with Henry Stapp not too long ago, and he refuses to acknowledge that Brenda Dunn and Bob John's work at Princeton is valid, even though it's been produced, you know, thousands of times, because the effects are subtle. So, I mean, they're fighting it.
Well, they always will. You know, how long did it take the British Navy to accept that citrus fruits cure scurvy.
Yeah.
What was it, like 200 or 300 years?
Yeah.
Even though they had absolute scientific proof, they wouldn't accept it for a couple of hundred years?
I wanted to ask you about the ketamine and the fight that goes on, that's gone on with ketamine. You know, ketamine, you talk about that a lot in your book, how it can produce the same kind of effects of a near-death experience.
But well, not exactly the same. It can produce imagery that seems to be similar. It can produce some of the feelings, but it does not produce the in-depth intensity of a near-death experience. It does not produce items, things, knowledge that could not have been known at all that the experiencer now knows or is privy to. It does not produce the long-term pattern of physiological and psychological after effects.
That's what I wanted to ask you.
Yeah. I mean, you get the superficial stuff, but you don't get the in-depth stuff.
How do the doctors respond to the people that get that knowledge, you know, that sudden knowledge of knowing pretty much all there is, you know?
Well, look at that Dr. John Hopkins Hospital. He perked up right away. He said, "You're a near-death experiencer." He changed how he treated her.
Mm-hmm.
Once in a while, you'll get a physician or a medical individual who is familiar with near-death states, and they will change how they are handling the patient, and especially they will change how they are treating them.
Do those kind of people with the drug get the mindsight awareness?
What's mindsight?
Mindsight.
Oh, mindsight. You're 360 degrees.
Right. Do they get that?
Some of them do. In fact, I'm going to see a lot of them do, and not with
that
the drugs.
Happens.
I mean, that's from the experience.
That's what I mean. Did they get it with that drug?
No.
Okay.
No. Not to my knowledge.
It wouldn't be logical for them to get that, it doesn't seem.
Well, it's not to my knowledge.
It wouldn't be physiological, really.
Yeah, no. Ketamine is basically, it gives you a taste of what a near-death type experience could be like, but you don't get the real thing or really anything that close to it. It's sort of like Persinger with his helmet up in Canada. You know, all you're getting is a superficial once-through. You're not getting anything of any depth or any lasting effect. You know, none of those experiments that these scientists are holding produce the after effects. None of them do. Lifelong
after effects. How do they account for that?
Well, hey, most of them can't. They can't account for it. They go mumble, mumble.
So, one thing that I wanted to ask you about: first of all, why do you think, or what can you say about most people having to go through some horrible thing for it to happen?
Well, who can make a reasonable comment here?
I'm just curious, because most of the people that I've interviewed that's had it happen have all been through a really dark, I mean, the worst dark night of their soul.
Sure. You know, the Bible and the various wisdom books of our world all say that it is through the dark night of the soul that we find ourselves, that we need to go through this kind of in-depth experiencing before we have any real concept of what spirituality really is, who we really are, and how the world really works. And if you look at the after effects, which is what I think validates all these kinds of experiences, it really takes a lot of pressure, a lot of intensity, a lot of, if you'll pardon the phrase, assault to the human body in order to turn it around. you know, you just don't sit down and start meditating, and you have a great meditation, and all of a sudden your body is physically transformed. Certainly that can happen in certain cases, but generally speaking, it takes a while, or it takes something with a lot of force to do that. And it's just the way we're made. It's the way the world works. Now, can you get it easier? Yes, you can. If you compare, for instance, the near-death experience to a lifetime of religious discipline and meditation, you're going to get very similar, if not the same, type of after effect, or the individual afterward, what they know, who they are, how they act, how they behave, how their body has changed, you're going to get the same or similar. So, you know, does it always have to be trauma? No, it doesn't.
To take that wanting to seek, I guess.
Well, you know, just the desire to truly want to be a better person. Sometimes will lead an individual to those activities or those experiences that begin to turn them around.
With all that you know that how it affects you afterwards,
mm-hmm.
What can you say to people that's going through that readjustment period? It's very hard, and people don't understand. What can you say to help them through that?
Well, I think the biggest thing is education. If they can start getting books, documentaries, CDs, DVDs on talks about this kind of thing, if they can become aware of the research, my work, I've gone deeper into the after effects than anybody else has, 9 books, you know, you can go through those various books, but a lot of other people have written about it too. There's a lot of material. I really encourage what we call newbies or those people who've just had an experience or had one, you know, not too long ago or not familiar with it. Hey, one of the first things I think you need to do is join IANS, the International Association for Near-Death Studies, or get on their website, get on my website, get on their website. Their website is www.iands.org. IANS, IANDS. Those initials stand for the International Association for Near-Death Studies. They're a clearinghouse. They're an international clearinghouse of this kind of information to absolutely anybody, anywhere. So get on the website or get on my website, again, www.pmhatwater.com, pmhatwater.com, my name. There's several other really good websites out there. If you get on the IANS website, you can link to a lot of the others that are out there that are very informative. And I truly feel education is step number one. Because it's very, very helpful to know what is normal, you know?
How do the little children deal with this?
Well, most children, in fact, all children compensate. They don't integrate. It takes the average adult between 7 to 10 years to integrate the experience. It takes the average child experiencer 20 to 30 years, maybe 40. To integrate the experience, because again, a child will compensate, they don't integrate. A child's job, Eva, is to survive. So if something happens, if they learn something, if they acquire different characteristics or traits or talents, and they try to use those at school or in their family or the world around them, and it doesn't work, then they'll try to cover them up or cast them aside, or they'll suppress them or repress them, or, you know, they'll try some way of avoiding it or calling it different or, you know, camouflaging it in some way, because, again, their job is to survive. If they can't survive as a very creative, inventive, psychic kind of individual, then they're going to compensate for that or adjust in some manner. And again, a child doesn't connect the dots. They have no way to connect the dots. You know, the child faces adults who say, oh, it's just your imagination, or shut up. You know, we don't want to hear about this. So what does a child do? You know, they do the only thing they can do. They put the stuff on a shelf. Well, they can't disguise the after effects. So they grow up feeling like they're alien. You know, like they must be from another planet, or they're mavericks, or, you know, there must have been a mix-up in the hospital when they were born, and obviously they belong to somebody else. You know, they couldn't possibly belong to their family.
I know I'm skipping all over the place, but by this time most people in the world have at least heard of it, a near-death experience, and you've got a lot more information than just about a near-death experience.
Oh, yeah.
And I learned something new in this book, The Knowledge of Your Own Death, which was a little bit shocking, but certainly logical. I can now see it in other people that I know. I'd like to talk about that a little bit.
Well, one of the I'm not sure if I'm going to touch on exactly what you saw in the book, because that's a big book, and, you know.
You bulleted some points about things that you start doing even though you don't realize what you're doing. You know, you start out talking about 3 months to 3 weeks before your death, they start to change behavior that's normal for them.
Oh, yes.
That was amazing. It's very observant for you to point that out.
That's that section where I talk about accidental death. And I'm noticing that no matter how a person is about to die, that we know we're going to die before we die. And I give the pattern I found. Now, that was long before I got into near-death research, long before I ever had my experience. I've been married twice in this lifetime. My former husband was a crop duster, and I'm from Idaho. And in Idaho, the bees are protected by law. So you cannot fly to spray anybody's fields until after the bees go to bed at night. So you're not flying until, you know, late in the afternoon, evening. And you have to quit flying. You have to quit spraying the fields before the bees wake up in the morning. So you quit at, like, you know, 6 in the morning or something, or 5 in the morning. I forget what the exact hours were, but most of your spraying is done at night flying. And you can imagine how dangerous that is, because there's a lot of poplar trees that, you know, line the fields of, you know, the pioneers planted these poplar trees for windbreaks. So the crop duster has to, you know, come in over the poplar tree and then come straight down as quick as they can. And you're spraying those fields, those rows in those fields, like maybe 6 to 8 inches above the dirt.
Wow.
So you're down low, and you make your run, and then you've got to rise really fast on the other end, because there might be power lines, there might be more poplar trees, there might be some outbuildings, what have you. And your ground crew has these really strong flashlights, and they step off the rows for you, but it's still very dangerous. So we lost a lot of people that we knew. We knew corporate pilots and, you know, bush pilots and backcountry pilots, and lost a lot of our friends. And then, of course, I'm a cop's daughter. I was raised in a police station. So I was either on hand or knew about a lot of deaths. And one of the things that I began to notice is that if you talk to the survivors, if you talk to the kin, you know, the loved ones who are left with this trauma, they would always say that their loved one changed their behavior, like 3 months before they died, or 6 months before they died, or 3 weeks before they died. And it was a very repeatable way. In other words, it was like it was standard, the way they would change their behavior. And among the things that they would start to do is become very, very concerned about their own bills and their own insurance, and did they have this, did they have that, was the family adequately taken care of, were the various projects that they had going, could they get them done in time, could they find somebody else to finish them for them, to sit down and instruct the spouse or the family members, I just want you to know where things are, and here's this file on this, and here's this over here, and I'd really like for you to have this. And they would start making these kind of plans, and I guess they're really very eerie to the extent that some of them will go. And, they don't always say that they have a sense they're going to die, but they just have this instinctual desire to sort of make sure everybody knows where everything is. And invariably, about 3 days before they die, that's average. Sometimes it's just a few hours. But the average person, about 3 days before they die, all of a sudden, they get real relaxed, really, really relaxed, and they start glowing. And they're not obsessive anymore. It's like before that, they want to see everybody, they want to tell them they really love them, or have these big discussions, or they want to travel and see all these things they never got to see. Boy, it's really meaningful, they want to do it now. So all of that obsessive stuff is over, and they just relax as if they expect something wonderful to happen.
That's really important information.
And then they die. And you find this a lot in accidents. You find it almost more in accidents than you do in diseases of any kind. These people who die in an airplane or who die in a car crash or... You find this pattern a lot in accidents. And one particular, I think we have time here, I'd like to share that one that happened in Twin Falls, Idaho. I'm an Idahoan. I'm a Westerner. And I'm living now in Virginia. At the time, I was going to move to Seattle, Washington. And I told everybody I took a wrong turn on the freeway and I wound up in Washington, D.C., the other Washington. So I wound up in the east instead of going further west. Do you know, to this day, my family has still never forgiven me. They haven't forgiven me. It's like a true Westerner never goes east. but I did, I was the black sheep of the family. I moved east. But anyway. Back in Twin Falls, Idaho, and this was, I don't know how many years ago or decades ago, but it's a while ago. And I was in on it. And there was a car crash. Two girls died. The two girls were seniors. They were about to graduate from high school. So the ceremonies were like in another week or a few days. Anyway, they were just about ready to graduate. And they were in this car. One of them was driving, of course. And that's the only two that were in the car. And they were just starting up at a stop sign, an intersection. And this crazy other guy goes barreling through. And his side was red. Their side was green. It was not their fault. It was his. And he just barrels right into him and kills both girls. And it was, you can imagine how devastating that was. And especially for the graduating class.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was just, huge, big, huge funeral. Terrible tragedy. Well, a year later, now we're talking a year later, the parents of these two girls never knew each other. They did not talk to each other after the funeral at all. So a year later, both mothers, unbeknownst to either one, started having dreams where they were visited by their dead daughter. And this one daughter, the one that was the most outspoken, she was showing this pattern of knowing you're going to die before you die.
Mm-hmm.
And she was showing this pattern, driving her parents nuts. They were scared to death. And, of course, she did die.
What was she doing? As a teenager, it's hard to imagine them preparing for death.
Yes, she knew she was going to die. Now, she was very open about this. She told her parents, she walked up to her parents and said, I'm going to die in 3 months.
Oh, my God.
You know, and they put her, you know, committed her to a psychiatrist and had her, you know, put her on drugs and all this kind of stuff, and they couldn't stop her. They couldn't. She says, I'm going to die soon. And they couldn't, and she did. Well, she came back to her mother after a year, and she says, Mother, I want you to know, well, I'm just paraphrasing everything here, you realize. But in essence, she said to her mother, Mother, I want you to know that I'm fine, that everything is just wonderful, and I want you to know that the only reason I was ever born was to die in that car crash, because I had agreed to help the driver of the car, and I don't remember what her name was, but I had agreed to help her because she had never experienced a violent death ever. Her soul had never experienced a violent death, and I had, and I agreed to come back and help her die. And it's the only reason that I was ever born.
Wow.
Well, the other daughter says to her mother basically the same thing. The only reason I was ever born was to die violently in a car crash. And that this other girl helped me do it. And that I was so blessed to have her there to help me. Well, both of these two women knew Johnny Lister, the local astrologer, who was a friend of mine. And they both separately went to Johnny and discussed their dream. They thought it was just a dream because it was so vivid. And Johnny, of course, listened to them and was coming unglued because both women were coming forward with the same story, and he drew me and said, what am I going to do? And I said, get a hold of a psychiatrist, especially the one that this one family took their daughter to, and have him sit down with both sets of parents, and have him let both women talk about their dreams. And you know, have a psychiatrist there. Mm-hmm. So he found a psychiatrist that would do that, and it was the same one, and got the parents to come, and Johnny was not there, I was not there, it was just the psychiatrist, but got the parents to come, and they told their stories, and it's just exact all the way through, just exact. And the healing that happened, even with the psychiatrist, changed the psychiatrist's life.
I can imagine.
The healing that came from that was phenomenal. Absolutely.
I can imagine
phenomenal.
That mother of the driver in particular would have been
healed. Yeah. And that was the only reason the girls claimed that they were ever born, was to die violently in that car crash. So the question becomes then, are all accidents accidents?
Well, that made me think about abortions.
Well, you know.
You know, or
so we can't call it, but, you know. And
the soul has a purpose to come and feel what it feels like to be aborted, and the mother that aborts has to have the experience of having an abortion and deal with those emotions.
Well, maybe yes, maybe no. You know what, one of the cases with children, And it's in the book, The New Children and Near-Death Experiences. I don't know if it's in the big book, but it's in the other one, The New Children and Near-Death Experiences. In that book is the story of Jimmy John. Now, that's not his name, but I use that as his name. Jimmy John was about 4 years old. He was an only child. Mom was in her late 20s. Dad was in his early 30s. They were Mormons. They lived in the Salt Lake City area. They had a swimming pool. And their boy did something with a swimming pool and slipped or something, and nobody was around, and he drowned. And of course, you know, they're pulling him out of the pool, and all the neighbors are over, and everybody's over, and the EMT crews are there, and they're trying to get this boy to breathe again. And it took about 15 minutes. Now, that's average. I'm going to take a little bitty detour here and say the average time out, what we say in research. In other words, the average time without vital signs, no breath, no pulse beat, no brainwave function. In other words, no vital signs is between 5 to 20 minutes. That's average for a near-death experiencer or in cases of the near-death experience. So this boy, 15 minutes, right around 15 minutes before they could get him to breathe again, they were able to resuscitate this little boy. And you can imagine the scene because everybody's praying for this boy to come back. And mom is white, and she's praying and praying. She's over the boy's face when he finally is able to breathe, and of course he's coughing, and you know, when he can finally talk, he's absolutely beaming. And he says, "Mommy, Mommy, I met my little brother, and he told me all about how you had him pulled from your tummy when you were 13.
Really?
Really? Well, everybody went into shock because mom had never told anybody. She was not a grieving mother. She'd forgotten about the whole thing. And the dad just, I mean, everybody just flipped out because this was a very strict, you know, family. And the boy went on to have a relationship with his little brother, who'd been dead for, you know, a long time, aborted. And mom had a nervous breakdown, and dad finally left the family, and they divorced. I don't know what happened to Jimmy John, but Jimmy John was just as happy as a clam. I mean, he would, you know, he was at peace, but it tore up the family. So, you know, how can you judge abortions? Sometimes maybe that's okay, and sometimes maybe that's not okay.
I don't know what to say. On one hand, I think about the non-dualistic point of view that everything's perfect in consciousness, and then you tell that story so you don't know.
Right. Well, you know, it was years ago, that's about 15 years into my research, I asked several thousand near-death experiencers, do you think there's any such thing as a sin? And the predominant answer was yes, and that there are two sins. And let's see, what were the sins? One of them was abortion, and the other one was suicide. Abortion and suicide, they felt, were sins.
Well, one thing I've thought a lot about that suicide thing myself. I wrote a chapter in my book about it, and I wonder, you know, if there's only one consciousness, and one of the reasons that it dangerous to commit suicide because only your body drops away and everything else is still the same, right? You know, mind's still the same.
As near as we know, uh-huh.
So what if, you know, a lot of enlightened people, and I've had this conversation with Elmer Green some, a lot of enlightened people don't want to be here anymore. You know, they want to go home. They're not interested in materialism anymore, and it's hard for them to live. And I've wondered if you're in that state where you have peace of mind, but you just don't want to be here anymore, and you committed suicide, what would happen then? Because you're not in that frantic or that crazy state, and you would think that this body just dropped away and you have peace of mind that you would know to go to the light.
Well, let me give you a couple of things to think about. Most near-death experiencers wouldn't want to return to the other side, but they don't want to do it by suicide. They want to stay here. They want to finish their job. They want to finish their mission. They'll go when it's time to go. And you find this thinking and this feeling throughout, whether it's adult or children. They're going to stay here. Even though they want to go, they're going to stay here because staying here, they feel, is very, very important. They don't want to blow it. And in your esoteric traditions, the thinking and feeling is that if you go before it is your time, then you will come back, and not only will you come back and have to go through it all over again, but it'll be harder. And each time it gets harder and harder because you have to stay here and work it through.
How do we know that that's not the way you're supposed to go that time, though?
Well, you know, I'm just giving you esoteric tradition. How do we know? Well, maybe it's insight, maybe it's dreams, maybe it's a psychic that tells you, maybe it's a feeling that you have, maybe it's a visitation that you have, maybe it's a voice that speaks to you. How do you know? Well, there's lots of different ways you can know. If you know it all.
Mm-hmm. What's the longest near-death experience, or the longest time out that you know?
That I know of was George Rodinia. George Rodinia died about a year and a half ago, so he's no longer with us. But his story is in my book, Beyond the Light. I think it's also in the big book of near-death experiences, because it was such an incredible story. He was dead 3 days, 3 nights. He was assassinated by the KGB in Tbilisi, Georgia. That was during the time of the Iron Curtain and, you know, the heavy stuff with Russia. Of course, we're getting back to some of that now. But anyway, he was a communist dissident when that was not cool. And he was assassinated by the KGB. And the body, because the situation was highly political and he was well known, his body was rushed to the hospital in Tbilisi and dead on arrival, so he's put in the morgue. Well, there in Tbilisi, the morgue is a freezer vault. So his body was put in a freezer vault. Now, we have no way of knowing what the actual temperature was. But his body was put in this freezer vault and stored there for 3 days before they brought it back out. So 3 days, 3 nights. And I think it was, yeah, well, anyway, 3 days. And then he brought him out, put him on the autopsy table because they had to do an autopsy. And one of his own uncles was part of the team of doctors cutting him open. There was a team. And they were doing what is called the T-cut. And the broad part of the T is the lower part of the front of the body, and then they go right up, you know, straight up the middle. So they cut open the bottom part, and they were now going up the middle. When his eyes came open.
Oh, my God.
Now, that's not necessarily a sign of anything except an automatic reaction of the body. So the doctors didn't think anything of it, and they just closed his eyes and kept cutting. Well, then his eyes came open a second time, and again, they didn't think anything of it. They closed his eyes and kept cutting. But his eyes then came open a third time, and that is not possible. And the head of the autopsy team screamed, jumped backward, and had to take a month vacation. He just couldn't handle it anymore. And they, of course, put him immediately into surgery. And I guess
it's the backup, I guess.
He was in surgery for like 3 months or more, a long time. And his case and his story is just mind-boggling. And and much of it we've been able to verify.
It makes you wonder about pulling the plug on somebody if they're just out of their body.
Yeah. Yeah, George's case, you know, he was in that freezer vault for 3 days anyway.
Jesus.
And then came back.
That's just amazing. But, you know, how long would you wait for somebody if they're in a coma like that to see?
Well, there's no, you know, there's no overall a protocol that we can give. This runs into, you know, your organ donation thing,
mm-hmm.
and that creates really an ethical dilemma because so many of these people come back usually within an hour, certainly within about 20 minutes, but yet, if you want that donor organ, you've got to go in after it within like 5 to 6, 7, maybe 10 minutes in order for it to be any good so you can transplant it.
So
it creates some real problems, a real dilemma here for physicians.
That's just mind-blowing. What did he say after it happened? Did somebody talk to him about it?
Oh, yeah. His is a very long story. One of the things that he did when he was dead, when he's, I guess one of the last things he did, a friend of his wife was due, and with a baby due for birth. So he went up. Of course, bear in mind, now we're talking about an invisible person. His soul, his spirit, went up to the maternity ward of this hospital to see if, in fact, his friend's wife had had her baby. And she had. She had a little girl and had just had it. And the little girl was screaming, just screaming. Well, George Rodanaya was a physician himself. And he said, you know, you have x-ray vision, you can see right through anything. And he could see through the child and see that baby, that newborn infant, had a broken hip. And he also knew instantly why the head nurse had dropped the child. And that's why the child had a broken hip. So he told the child to shut up, to quit crying. He would take care of her as soon as he could. And he said, you can talk to animals and kids. I mean, they can see and respond. And the baby responded and quit crying. And it was soon after that he revived. Well, you know, when you're dead, your tongue swells up and fills the mouth cavity. So he couldn't talk at all until the swelling went down. And it took several days for the swelling to go down, so that he could speak. And the first thing he said to the physicians was, go up there to that maternity ward. And because he was a physician, he could describe exactly what the break was, what it looked like, where it was, you know, all this dimensional stuff that doctors love to hear, and that the child had a broken hip, and why? Because the head nurse dropped the child. So they went right up there, they x-rayed this little baby, and sure enough, the baby had the broken hip exactly as Rodanaya had described. They confronted the head nurse, and yes, she had dropped the baby, and she was fired.
Oh, dear. Did his brain swell? How did his organs react to that?
I can't answer that.
That's just an amazing story.
Well, it just goes on and on and on. I mean, he was inside his wife's head when she was you know, standing in the cemetery picking out, you know, where she's going to lay her husband. And going over in her mind, she's a widow with two kids, going over in her mind the different men and bachelors and different characteristics and traits, because she's going to have to find a father for her children. And, you know, he's in...
All right, we got to go, PMH.
Okay.
I'm sorry. It was just such an interesting story.
Well, cut that part out.
It's a good story. Tell me your website again.
It's www.pmhatwater.com.
Thanks for coming on.